Welcome to this special edition of the Reaction podcast, where I'm talking to Rory Stewart, who's standing to be leader of the Tory party and has made quite a splash on social media with his walking and talking tour of the UK, visiting various venues, just back from Peterborough by-election. And I mean, is it fair to say, Rory Stewart, that when you started this, people gave you very little hope of success, but do you feel that you're picking up momentum?
I think I am picking up momentum. I mean, a lot will depend, of course, on MPs' votes. The challenge is that although I'm reaching a lot of people on social media, and in fact beginning to get polling, which is showing that for a lot of the key target votes, I would be in a good position to win a general election, translating that to MPs is quite difficult. And it's partly quite difficult because I'm coming to this race very, very late. Having declared, and I think I was almost the first to publicly admit that I was interested in running, of course it becomes apparent that other people have had PR companies and various things working for them for, I think, a year or more. And MPs are deeply, deeply loyal. So often what I'm getting is people saying...
Are they? Is that true?
They are, oddly. I mean, although they're famously, there are all these great quotes about them being the most duplicitous electorate in the world... No, loyalty is really prized, and I think one of the interesting things is the number of people who write to me saying, I really want to live in a country in which you could be Prime Minister, or I'd really like you to be Prime Minister, but I was the PPS to X, or I already committed to Y 3 weeks ago, I didn't realise you were running. And I should have known this, because when I ran to be chair of the Defence Select Committee successfully, my real advantage was that I moved fast and got everybody to commit to me before anyone else entered the field. And actually the loyalty really counts. And I found in that election that people who said they were going to vote for me did vote for me, even though it's a secret ballot.
Mm. So the first vote is, well, the first hustings, leadership hustings is coming up. And do you have a sense yet with how long until the first round of voting? Do you have a sense yet? It's about a week away. Mm. How many of your colleagues you've managed to persuade? Even if you can't at the moment
put a finger on it. I would, in order to come through with any real momentum in this, I'd probably have to land something in the region of 20 colleagues in the first round and then hope to pick up colleagues who then fell away. So a loss of the... If I made it in through two or three rounds, I think I'd be in a very strong position because I represent a very distinctive vision of the party, and I think a lot of people would come on board. But I think the challenge is making sure that we make it through the first two to three rounds. And there, the problem, of course, is that by having 12 candidates in the race, you split the vote every way. I was very, very interested in working with James Cleverly, and we talked about this some weeks ago. And he ultimately decided that he wanted to run himself, and I think it's a great, great pity, because in fact we would have been a really interesting team. You know, he's a committed Brexiteer, I voted Remain, but I'm now in favour of Brexit. We come from different backgrounds, we represent different parts of the party, but we're both people who enjoy communicating, we're both people who... could, as a team, I think, have really electrified people. And one of the sadnesses of this campaign is that instead of forming teams, everybody's been running solo.
Isn't it rather healthy, though, that there has been, after, well, 2016 was uncontested as a Tory leadership election, I mean, people are criticising the fact that there are a dozen people running, and there might even be 15 or 16 by the end of it. There is at least this proper open contest running, and people are being forced to declare, and candidacies are being made and unmade in the full glare of public attention, or media attention anyway, very quickly. It's a healthy process, surely.
It's a very, very healthy process. And I think on two things in particular, it's been very healthy. Getting people to be honest about their Brexit positions. So very, very quickly, we're going to weed out the people who are pretending they're going to negotiate some different deal with Brussels, and get it down to a pretty stark competition, I believe, between people like me, who believe that we can get this deal, this withdrawal agreement, through Parliament, and people who think they can get no deal through Parliament, right? That's the basic choice here. And I think on economic policy, it's going to come down to some very stark, brutal questions in which, at the moment, I feel that I am almost the only fiscal economic conservative running in this race. I'm the only person who is not making huge spending commitments. Some of them are even saying, OK, I'm going to take you to no deal Brexit. I admit that no deal Brexit will be disruptive, and I will cut 5p off tax, and I will make further spending commitments. So I'm a conservative in the sense that I simply do not believe that we should be spending money that we don't have, and that is incredibly important for this country as we go through Brexit. It's hugely important for the credibility and the brand of the Conservative Party. So that's actually, in a way, why I'm particularly proud to have David Gawk and Ken Clark backing me. Not because their views on Brexit, which is what everybody focuses on, but because actually what attracts them to me, and it's what they said to me straight off, was that I'm the only person not making unfunded pledges. Ken Clark was a fiscal conservative, right? He's a fiscal hawk.
Mm. Just park Brexit just for a moment, if that's possible, and address that question of fiscal conservatism. Isn't it, though, the reality, even quite a few deficit hawks can see that the reality is that the political landscape in which a new Conservative Party leadership leader will be operating is such that the pressure from public on questions around the condition, the health or otherwise, of the public realm, on education spending, for example, which Boris Johnson has focused on police and crime, on the extraordinary pressures on local government. Other candidates are focusing on that for a reason, because don't they grasp that there is a kicking coming from the electorate unless the Conservatives reposition post this leadership election and have something clear and coherent on those issues? And that's going to involve spending extra money, surely.
It will involve spending extra money. And there's no doubt at all that we must put more money into education. Particularly need to put more money, given what's happening with robotics and AI, which is going to lead to millions of people losing their jobs, into providing bursaries for people in midlife to educate themselves for new careers. We're going to have to put more investment into police. We don't have enough police on the streets, and people do not feel safe on the streets. And we also need to invest more in R&D. Now, not all of this stuff, let's take that one, that can involve taking money from the existing DFID budget, putting into things like solar film, light spectrum technology in universities in Britain, if we're dealing with global public goods. But you're right, we would have to spend more money. If we were able to get a sensible Brexit deal through, there would be a surge of investment, business confidence would return. I believe that we would have some billions to play with. But we need to be very clear that we will spend that money if we have that money, right? And I'm very clear that if we have that money, and I think we will have some of that money, yes, of course, it's perfectly reasonable to imagine that you could put, for example, something in the region of another billion into education. It's perfectly reasonable to imagine that you could increase police numbers. Not up to where they were, but you could increase police numbers. What would not be reasonable under any scenario is to double defence spending. And defence spending is currently about £43 billion. Whatever you have in the budget, you can't add another £43 billion to our spending.
So that's a reference to the position adopted by Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary, who's committed, I think, to, is it 4% of GDP? Why on earth has he done that? It sounds, I would regard myself as pretty hawkish on defence, but an argument for 4%, is that a mistake by him, or is that a deliberate calculation?
Actually, Jeremy is not doing something for which only he personally needs to be picked out. Every single candidate has done this. Right? Every single candidate is now on record either saying they're going to turn on the spending taps, or they're going to outdo each other in education spending, or yes, that's a huge thing that Jeremy Hunt's talked about. This is what I mean by populist politics. In a sense, I'm a sort of Trumpian anti-Trump. I'm Trumpian in the sense that I'm going out on social media, and if I can't get for example, the Daily Telegraph to cover my social care policy, I can put it out on social media and I get 600,000 people to view it. But I'm deeply, deeply anti-populist in not believing that the way that you should be trying to win a conservative election is being making spending pledges that you can't afford, because the fundamental consequence of that is not just the erosion of the conservative brand, it's a poorer country, and a poorer country in the long term can't fund any of this stuff. So a lot of what the government needs to do is not about tens of billions of pounds of expenditure, it's about actually getting on and doing well the things that it needs to do. Relatively small things would make a huge difference in people's lives. Abolishing hospital car parking charges is not going to turn the budget of the NHS on its head, right? It's a tiny fraction, but it would make a huge difference to my constituents who go and visit a mother dying in hospital and come out and get a hospital car parking charge. Trying to make sure that when we spend our overseas development money, we're using that to invest in R&D in British universities is smart. You can transform housing in this country, and you could borrow against that, but that's because those are marketable assets. Those are houses that can be sold or rented. So government gets something for its money, and this is a very good time to borrow for 40 years. But the bigger picture, the really big picture, which is why I am very much pushing against this no-deal Brexit, is that fundamentally international market confidence, economic confidence in Britain is going to depend on how we land Brexit, how we do it. Right? I'm absolutely committed to Brexit, but we've got to land it right to reassure people. And in Peterborough, I spent half an hour arguing with the Brexit Party about this.
Because you ran into, I saw this on social media, you ran into a group of Brexit Party campaigners.
And it was a very interesting debate. I suddenly realised that none of them had any idea what they meant by no-deal Brexit. Right? If I said to one of them, OK, are you going zero tariff with the world and agriculture? He says, absolutely, I believe in free trade. Right? So then I say, OK, so that's Argentinian beef coming in, that's Brazilian beef coming in, that's American wheat coming in. It's the end of our farming industry. That is the end of our farming industry, I promise you. Right? That stuff comes in at 40% below what we can produce. Oh, well, no, I'm not in favour of that, says somebody else. No, of course, you know, I believe in Trump. I want protectionist trade barriers around us. OK, so I want to know, what is this no deal? WTO rules just means that you have to do the same thing to everybody. It doesn't tell you what they're doing with their trade and economic policy. What are they doing with the motor industry, which employs 850,000 people in this country? And getting that right, getting down to those details, well, they get extremely frustrated, I'm afraid, despite all the charm and exuberance of the Boris campaign, that he will not sit down and talk to me about these details. What tariff levels is he talking about?
So when you infamously tried to have a conversation with him, or you did have a long conversation with him a few weeks ago about some of these issues, what did he say?
He said to me, come on, Rory, why do you keep accusing me of being in favour of a no-deal Brexit? I'm not in favour of a no-deal Brexit. So I said, well, if that's true, please come out and say that straight away, because it would enormously reassure people like me, and I will then stop attacking you. And he said, well, right, etc. So I left the room, and actually for the next 10 days, 2 weeks, I was scrupulous in avoiding criticising him in any way at all.
And is that a personal best, 10 days without attacking Boris?
I
it's a world record.
The irritating thing here is that people are very, I think, misleadingly trying to conflate discussions about policy with conversations about personality. When I came out and said I cannot serve as his international development secretary or foreign secretary if he's pushing for a no-deal Brexit, yeah, People said, oh, you're being divisive, you're attacking Boris, why are you making this personal? This is monstrous. This is absolutely monstrous. This campaign needs to be about ideas. It needs to be about policies. And if I'm not allowed to disagree with his policies without being accused of being divisive, and if everybody comes out pompously saying, what we need in this party is unity, how on earth am I going to be able to explain to members of Parliament, or indeed to the associations who are voting, what the problems are with this no-deal idea? It's delay, it's uncertainty, it's going to be unbelievably difficult to get through Parliament, and almost certainly what it's going to mean is that we're still going to be in the European Union in the middle of next year.
Okay, so you're opposed to no deal. Mm-hmm. You think that no deal is a complete disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But so here's the situation facing any new leader of the Conservative Party, whether it's you or it's Boris or it's Michael Gove or Jeremy Hunt.
Yep.
There isn't really a commission to negotiate with.
Mm-hmm.
The commission is coming towards the end of its mandate. Barnier is technically still in place, but Barnier is a candidate to be president of the European Commission. So you're into September, you're into August, everyone's on the beach. September, there's no one really to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably heading for a European Council with October the 31st, with Macron saying it is this deal,
mm-hmm.
as in the deal mm-hmm. that was negotiated, or it is no deal.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously choose
this deal.
This deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't pass the House of Commons.
Okay.
So you're stuck.
Let's spool back through this. That would matter if you were trying to negotiate a different deal. So what you've just pointed out is catastrophic for all the candidates who are claiming they're going to negotiate a different deal before October. Right? People who are saying, I'm going to get movement on the backstop, I'm going to get alternative bridges.
Yeah.
I'm the only person who's saying, this is the deal. Europe is not going to give us a different deal by October. And another thing follows from that. If you're Boris saying, I'm going to try to negotiate a different deal, and if I don't get it by October 31st, I'm leaving, what you've just explained is why he is actually in favour of no deal. He must know perfectly well, for all the reasons you just pointed out, he's not going to get any different deal before 31st of October. So that way of articulating it is just a way of saying he's going to go for no deal. He's leading us to no deal.
Right.
So there are two fundamental issues here. The first is that, yes, if Europe kicked you out, you would get no deal. But if you tried to take no deal through Parliament, you would find it very, very difficult. All this talk about no deal being the legal default, it's only the legal default because Parliament made it the legal default. Parliament can stop that being the legal default just as easily as they made it the legal default. Parliament passes laws.
Mm.
Parliament could remove the date. Parliament could say the minister could set the date. Parliament could pass a law instructing the Prime Minister to accept an extension from Brussels, in which case the no dealers' only tactic is to gamble the House on the possibility that Brussels would itself decide unilaterally to kick Britain out. And I think it's extremely unlikely that the European Union would choose to do that because it would be disruptive for the European Union. It doesn't particularly help its economy, and they don't want to carry the can. They don't want to have the responsibility of this whole thing. So under pressure, Europe will extend, which is why. Don't get into this nonsense about I'm threatening no deal in order to get a different deal out of Brussels. This is the deal. We got 270 votes behind this deal. In very blunt, simple terms, the question is, how do you get 45 Labour MPs to vote for the deal? This was all it comes down to. And it's a good deal. We have to keep coming back. This not only is the only deal, it's a good deal. It's a deal that makes sense for us. We leave the Commission. We leave the Parliament. We give up on fantasies of EU army. We're no longer paying them billions of pounds. We take control over immigration. And yes, until alternative arrangements were in place, we would be part of a common market system. But actually, that's a very good thing for our car industry. That's a very good thing for our agriculture. So it's a good deal. So the only question then is which one of these candidates is most likely to be able to get this deal through Parliament. We live in a parliamentary democracy. Right, everybody keeps pointing out the problems in Parliament. Everyone keeps saying Theresa May failed to get it through Parliament again. But there's nothing else you can do. You have to take it through Parliament. Have to take it through Parliament. Right? So that's where I believe the prize goes to the candidate who is most likely to be able to unlock Parliament and then most likely to be able to negotiate with Parliament. And the way that you unlock Parliament is you take seriously the fact that core group of Labour MPs, of whom there were nearly 80 who've ruled out a second referendum, they come from Brexit voting seats, they keep saying they're about a quarter of an inch apart from us on the deal, have all said that if a citizens' assembly, a Brexit assembly, was held, like the abortion assembly in Northern Ireland, to take away the binary in-out choice and to look in the details of a deal and make a recommendation to Parliament, then they would accept that recommendation. That's the way, to put it in very, very blunt terms, that's the way that you work to get Lisa Nandy from Wigan, who keeps saying to me that she wants to vote for this deal, to vote for that deal. And
You accept the possibility there that, so the Citizens' Assembly sits when?
In August.
Sits in August in, whereabouts? Sits in Westminster Hall, or it sits in locations around the country?
Probably would sit in Westminster, because we'd probably want to use the committee rooms of the House of Commons. If we had the permission of the Speaker to do this, we'd use the clerks, because it would operate very, very similarly to a parliamentary committee. In the same way, it would have expert witnesses, expert staff, parliamentary clerks, it would take evidence, it would get Barnier in, it would take Farage in, and it would break into subcommittees, and then it would come together. I mean, that's almost entirely how it operated on the abortion issue in Ireland. And what they discovered is that by doing that, you get out of the choice between pro-abortion and anti-abortion into how does a fetus develop? What happens if the woman was raped? What do we think about mental health and suicide issues? And in the case of Brexit, you get out of I'm a second referendum remainer or I'm a no dealer into what types of tariff schedules work for the British motor industry? You know, what do we do about non-tariff barriers? Do we want regulations over the City of London? I don't. Right? And I imagine anybody who looks at this would decide that a single market doesn't work for those reasons. But effectively, it pushes people out of a binary position towards compromise. Now, it may not work. Right? It's quite possible it may not work.
Or it could recommend a policy that you're not comfortable with. So your Prime Minister, you've appointed the Citizens' Assembly, and it says, actually, we've decided this is broadly a terrible deal.
So if the Citizens' Assembly were to come out arguing for one of three things, there would clearly be an issue, right? And you're quite right in saying that there's a risk. There's a risk they could come out saying, we are recommending no deal. There's a risk that they could come out saying, we're recommending second referendum. I think it's highly unlikely, because what we know is that the country is split almost 50-50 on these kinds of issues, and this is a representative assembly, so it's extremely unlikely they would arrive at those positions. It's possible they could arrive at what I would call a unicorn position. In other words, we'd be happy if you got some completely different deal out of the EU, in which case it would be absolutely essential when they were taking expert evidence that they understood all the things you've just explained about what's going on in the European Union and understood about how unlikely it is that the European Union's going to shift its negotiating position. But ultimately, Parliament is sovereign. So if the Citizens' Assembly come forward with recommendations that instead of enlightening anyone, instead of providing a pragmatic, sensible solution to the problem, comes up with recommendations that are unacceptable to Parliament, then Parliament will reject them. And where will I be? Well, in the worst case scenario, I will have wasted 4 weeks of your time. But it's much, much better to try that, much better to try that, because in the end, unlocking Parliament has to be the key to this.
So if it hasn't worked, your Prime Minister, Citizens' Assembly has produced something that you are uncomfortable with and that Parliament won't pass. So you have just another unpassable option. What do you do then?
Well, you have to begin, I'm afraid, with a very stark, unpleasant truth, which we're all avoiding, which is this is a parliamentary democracy. So if you can't get something through Parliament, you can't get something through. It is the analogy I try to use, as I would say that everybody can point out the difficulties of Parliament, but it's like Shackleton on the South Pole. He's got to get across the sea to South Georgia. Everybody keeps pointing out the difficulties in the sea, but there's no alternative. You've got to cross that sea. You've got to cross Parliament. So at that point, the question would be, am I sufficiently intelligent, nimble, flexible, creative, skilled as a negotiator to be able to negotiate and get an agreement with Parliament? My first move in that scenario would be to move to a single transferable vote system and force Parliament to come to a decision. So actually change the structural voting system in Parliament to compel them to come to a positive rather than a negative conclusion.
To try and get them to support the deal, or to support the deal plus customs union plus referendum?
The objective would be to get them to support the deal, because that's where the votes are. Really what's happening here is a story about whips and political parties and constituencies, which has meant that although 80 Labour MPs basically agree with every word of that deal, they won't vote for it. Now, I will be coming at this, if you go through the thought experiment of my becoming Prime Minister, from a completely different direction from Theresa May. I'm coming into this explicitly with a mandate for this deal. I'm coming in without having set red lines. I'm coming in explicitly saying you are voting for me to go to Labour and work with them to get this deal through. That changes a great deal. It means that in the entire tone of that conversation, instead of what I sat through day after day sitting with the Prime Minister on the bench, hearing Labour saying, this is your fault, this is a hard Brexit, you set these red lines, it's you that won't compromise. This is a completely different conversation. And it's a conversation that isn't only taking place here, it's a conversation taking place with 2.2 million people watching me talk about Brexit on Twitter. And it's a completely different tone of Prime Minister. Furthermore, what is their other objection to the withdrawal agreement? The one that they raised again and again is, yeah, but what happens if we vote for this and we get Boris as Prime Minister? I've answered that problem. No, you haven't got Boris as Prime Minister, you got me as Prime Minister. Vote for the deal.
Let's assume for a second, you said this thought experiment, let's assume just for a second that it doesn't work, that you don't make it through the MP round, and that someone with a position that you really oppose, like Boris's position, becomes Prime Minister. And it seems likely, I think we agree that there isn't really much scope for renegotiation with the European Union. Interestingly, now the people that I hear from, who say that there is some scope for movement, are actually sort of Brussels watchers who are now getting very nervous, and actually quite a lot of anti-Brexit people who tell me that yes, just there might be an adjustment on the backstop. I'm not buying it. I don't think there is scope at all. So there isn't an extra bolt onto the deal to be done. Parliament doesn't like the deal. The new Prime Minister isn't you.
Yep.
They're not advocating the deal. Yep. It's then going to come down fairly rapidly, and I know you're searching for consensus and compromise.
Yep.
But it's going to come down fairly rapidly this autumn to revoke versus Brexit, deal or no deal, isn't it?
No. I mean, this is what people keep saying around the Cabinet table, and I disagree. I don't think there's a majority for either in Parliament. I mean, the hard Brexiteers wish that were true. Right? They keep trying to say to me, OK, ultimately, it's going to be revoke or no deal, which you're going to choose. It's completely obvious to me there's no majority in Parliament for either. Parliament would block both. What they're actually looking at is limbo land. They're going to be stuck in purgatory for another 12 months.
There's another thing, though, to consider, which is, as someone in town from Brussels...
Sorry, limbo and purgatory, of course, different. I apologize.
It just feels the same. But someone who's in town from Brussels said to me recently, someone not unsympathetic to the British position, but very much concluding that Macron is determined to throw the UK out. Why? Because he has... The situation is exactly where Macron would want it. If you were, as this person put it, Charles de Gaulle, trying to design 30, 40, 50 years ago the perfect Gaullist solution for Europe, it would look a bit like now. It would look like Britain being out, a weak Germany, or a Germany lacking confidence in its status, and a strong France, and a dispensation in the Commission, headed possibly by someone French, and you've won. So in those circumstances, Macron's not going to move at all. I can't see how he would. It'd be astonishing that Macron would be convinced by Boris Johnson.
In that scenario, if the European Union chose to throw us out, there's absolutely nothing we could do about it, right? And in that situation, I'm very clear that people in this country voted to leave. There's no mandate to revoke, right? So it seems to me that in that situation, Parliament would do all it can at this end to block a Prime Minister going for no deal or block a Prime Minister going for revoke. But if the European Union chose to kick us out, then my British nationalism comes to the fore and I say, OK, we'll make this work. I think it's going to be very difficult. I think most of these unfunded spending promises these people have made will be for the birds. I don't think they can possibly do 5% tax cuts in that situation. I think we may have to put up protectionist barriers, which currently Jacob Rees-Mogg and the others wouldn't countenance, in order to protect our agricultural industry. And we go through a pretty tricky time in terms of consumer prices, inflation. I think we're going to have bigger social welfare payments. I think interest rates are going to move, and I think all of that is going to put a significant drag on our economy, but Coursework comes through. I mean, this isn't... I mean, there's one of the... it will be a situation in which we will have a difficult time, and all those people who are fed up with austerity will find that we are in a very tricky spending situation, but we'll come through it. And in 5-10 years' time, of course, Britain will flourish again. But the problem is that the... What I resent in this is not people saying we'll survive. Of course we'll survive and flourish. And, you know, we are an enormous economy, and trade is not vital to our economy. I mean, one of the ironies of this that are kind of driving me crazy in this debate is that the Brexiteers seem to want to have their cake and eat it. On the one hand, they say they hate the fact that the backstop would trap us in something that feels like the customs union because they want to make these trade deals all around. On the other hand, they say trade isn't that important to our economy anyway. Why are we getting so hung up on trade, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it depends how you count it, but it's roughly 70% of the UK economy is domestic, and of the portion that's not, slightly more is the rest of the world and growing. And
So there's a slightly weird
less than thing. Half is less than half is the EU,
and actually of our trade, an enormous amount of it is services. So we're not a big manufacturing export economy in terms of the fundamental structure of our economy. So,
instead, I was going to ask you, do you think that should change? Just very quickly, Neil O'Brien of Onward has some very interesting ideas on this, on essentially trying to rebalance the UK economy and tilt things, if not decisively, but back towards manufacturing a bit. I just wondered if it's one of those ideas. When I read his proposals, for example, on capital, on investment, I thought there's an idea that could...
Yeah.
Could take
hold. I think that's true. So one of the reasons I'm passionately in favour of zero tariff, zero quota access to the European Union is that I think there are far more opportunities for British manufacturing if we can retain that deal. If we go to a no deal where we end up in a zombie land trying to negotiate for 3-5 years a future deal with Europe, a future deal with the US, a future deal with goodness knows who, British manufacturing is going to be in a very, very difficult problem. And actually, if you lose 3-5 years... of your manufacturing output and growth, it's actually very difficult to rebuild that base. So it's exactly because I want to be building, for the sake of argument, a couple of million electric cars a year in Britain in 15 years' time, and selling them into the European markets, given the Europeans have made this very ambitious commitment to electricity, that I want to get that zero tariff access to European markets. It's partly because I think the world is actually moving in a position where there is a premium on the type of food that Britain produces, high animal welfare standards, good nutritional value in the food, that I actually want to remain within the European agricultural trading system rather than open up. So a lot of my visions for where the jobs are, where the future is in the manufacturing sector and the economy, depends on having a market of 300 million people with whom we can compete in manufacturing. We cannot compete at the bottom of the market with China in manufacturing. We can't compete with India. And in many of these areas, we're not really going to be able to compete with the United States. So it's because I believe manufacturing matters in our economy. If I were like Patrick Minford or Jacob saying the car industry is yesterday's industry, I don't care about car manufacturing, we're all going to go services, this is Singapore, we're not going to manufacture anything anymore. And Patrick Minford testified to the Foreign Affairs State Committee and said to me, it's going to go like coal industry, all we've got to do is, you know, put some development investment in, we'll find some other jobs for these people, but I'm afraid, you know, there's 850,000 jobs, just face it, they've gone, right? But who on earth is explaining to the Brexit Party that that's what Patrick Minford is saying? I don't think the majority of people in this country are up for that. I think they will feel, as I do, that that is 850,000 breadwinners and their associated families who are going to find it very difficult, just as coal workers did, to find a different profession. I think it's all very well saying, in a macroeconomic sense, there'll be cheaper food for people, and yes, it'll have an impact on British agriculture, but what does that actually mean for a valley in Cumbria, this dairy farm, these 6 sheep farmers, and the village shop, and the bus, and everything else that goes around it?
Final question. We're sitting in your office in Westminster, and you're just about to go off, and you're meeting lots of MPs and trying to convince them to give you their votes in the first ballot. What do you say to them, to sceptics among your colleagues who might say, well, listen, you're doing a really amusing, interesting job on Twitter and on social media, but you can't win, so I'm not going to vote for you. How do you persuade them?
Two things. I show them the polling data, which is that I outperform every other candidate in the top categories of the key voters we need to win a general election.
And those are?
They are younger voters, they are Lib Dem and Labour swing voters, they are more than 4 million Conservatives who voted Remain at the last election, and that this policy of trying to out Farage Farage is a mistake, because the way to deal with the Brexit Party is to get Brexit done. And I'm much more likely to get Brexit done because I'm much more likely to get it through Parliament than these other people. So vote for me to get Brexit done, then vote for me to beat Jeremy Corbyn, then vote for me to reunify the country. And I think the other thing I'd probably say is, if you think this is all about social media and Twitter, debate me. With the possible exception of one of these candidates, I suspect I am able to be, at least, says he modestly, their intellectual equal.
The candidate you're mentioning, I assume, is Michael Gove.
Yeah, Michael, I have enormous admiration.
And you could serve under Michael if you don't win.
Yes, I could, absolutely, because I have enormous admiration for his... Well, actually, it's not so much his brains. I mean, I think he's a very bright guy, and I think that's extremely important, unfortunately. I mean, it's kind of unfashionable, but it is quite important to imagine something. But what I feel also that I bring and he brings is both of us like getting things done. I mean, I also try to encourage colleagues to look at what I did as a flooding minister, what I did as a prisons minister, my reputation with civil servants, my ability to administer, drive things through, or what I did before I came into Parliament. I mean, that in a sense is where, when I sit around the cabinet table, my respect for Michael comes from. He is, like me, somebody who, yes, can talk, but above all, get things done.
If you don't make it through, can Gove take out Boris? Can he beat Boris?
Well, I suppose the question...
Tory Association?
I mean, look, I've just told you how much of an admirer I am for Michael, and I really mean that. I think the central question is, quite brutally, who would win a general election, me or Michael? Who actually is going to be able to win over those key votes, those young votes, the Lib Dem votes, the Labour votes, the Remain votes? Who is actually a retail politician? Who can actually communicate with people on the streets? Why is it that I can put out a video on social care and get 600,000 people watching it and these guys can't? Why can I talk about Brexit and get 2.3 million people? And not a single one of these candidates, with the possible exception of Boris, can begin to cross 100,000. So I think what I'd say to Michael if I was challenging, politely, because he's a hugely experienced man who I have a huge admiration for, is which one of us do you think is actually more likely to win an election?
Rory Stewart, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.